We negotiate peace now. It's talk like that that makes us look like cowards, she said sharply. Where's your fighting spirit, Mrs. Tilling? I nodded weakly and studied the shelves of tinned peas for a few moments before deciding to leave the shop without buying anything. You see, I don't have a fighting spirit. The thought of all-out war overwhelms me. I feel like Britain is a bird wounded from the last battle, and there's a savage crow right there, ready to push us out of our nest and take over. I had to get on. Apart from my other visits, I had to check on Mrs. Winthrop and baby Lawrence. The Brigadier has been keeping me away, insisting that Miss Poultry is saying to her, which is ridiculous, as I'm just as well qualified. But today I heard that the Brigadier was going to London, which left the coast clear. I was desperate to hear about her birth story, find out how it fit in with Hattie's. So I trudged determinedly up to the manor. Mrs. Winthrop was looking exhausted.
"He can't stop crying, poor lamb," she sniffed. "Nanny Godwin says she's never seen anything like it."
"Well, I'm afraid some babies are like that. It'll pass with time." I scooped him up to calm him down, his dark, scraggy hair glued to his scalp with the sweat of crying. "Now, tell me about the birth. Did Miss Poultry give you some medicine at all?"
"Yes, some nasty green stuff. I thought I was going to be sick, but then the contractions started. It might even have brought them on," she mumbled, almost as if she were talking to herself. "But the dreadful part was when the baby came, and she had to rush him away to her house because of the breathing problem."
"What?" I thought. "Another breathing problem? Did you see that he wasn't breathing?"
"No, I hardly saw him before she took him away."
"Tell me exactly what happened." She gushed forth about how Miss Poultry saved baby Lawrence's life by whisking him away to her house to use the ventilating machine. It seems incredible that two babies had the same breathing problem in the same day. Perhaps it had something to do with the medicine. But no matter how many questions I asked, I simply couldn't get to the bottom of it. After I left, I had to deal with a billeting problem. Since I am the billeting officer in Chilbury, I'm responsible for finding spare bedrooms for evacuees or war workers. And because Chilbury is 5 miles from the Lichfield Park War Centre, I'm continually getting called upon to find more beds for their people. Now they need another 2 rooms for senior staff. I tried half the village before giving up. "But what about your David's room?" Mrs. B snapped as we congregated for choir practice. "He's in France now. There's no reason for you to keep his room empty when there's so much need."
"Yes," Mrs. Quayle stepped in. "Here you are, foisting goodness knows who on everyone else, and you're not even prepared to take one yourself."
"David's only just left. You can't expect me to give up his room just like that."
I thought I was going to burst into tears, but quickly pulled myself together.
"In any case, I don't see you giving up Henry's room," I retorted to Mrs. B.
"He's an RAF pilot and comes home on leave." She puffed herself up a little. I can't bear how she goes on about RAF pilots and how they're the creme de la creme of the military, as if David's some little nobody worthy of a bullet or two.
"That's not the point," Mrs. Quayle came to the rescue, but then turned on me again.
"But Mrs. Tilling, you can't call yourself a billeting officer if you don't billet yourself. It's not fair."
"Indeed. You said these new billets are for important bigwigs at Lichfield Park," Mrs. B snipped. "Ivy House is the perfect place for someone to stay whilst working their hardest to win this war, and you have a telephone, too. There aren't many houses in the village with one of those. It's your duty, Mrs. Tilling, to take one in."
"Don't you have a telephone, Mrs. B?" Mrs. Quayle snipped back. "Surely you can find space for a bigwig." As if by magic, Prim swooped down the aisle. "Ladies, it's time to rehearse." Everyone fell quiet and went to their places, except for Mrs. B, who was still quietly smarting. "We need to focus on Ave Maria tonight, for the competition.
Let's start at the beginning and take it to the end of the chorus.
Mrs. Quail pounded out the introduction, and then we jumbled the entry and were off key and far too loud.
What a muddle, Prim said when we come to the end. You're all out of balance with each other. Now, let's try a few arpeggios.
We did some arpeggios and then some scales and sounded a little more together, but the argument had put us out of keel. During one of the scales, Mrs. B thumped her music score down and marched off out of the church.
Right. Let's try Ave Maria again, Prim continued, ignoring the departure.
It was better, but still not good.
It's simply too difficult, Kitty whined.
Perhaps we should pull out, I said quietly.
We'll do nothing of the sort, Prim said in a jovial way. We'll jolly well do our best and enjoy it, as will our audience. No, we may not win, but taking part is what counts. Being there, being heard, being alive.
She smiled, and I found myself smiling too. And as I looked around me, I realized that everyone else had cheered up.
Prim was right. It's not about winning. It's about finding humanity in the face of this war. It's about finding hope when everything around us is collapsing, including my own precious home.
Letter from Venetia Winthrop to Angela Quail. Tilbury Manor, Tilbury, Kent. Tuesday, the 14th of May, 1940. My dearest Angela, I know you told me not to fall in love with him, but I just can't help myself. It's been only a few weeks, but we're virtually inseparable. I've taken to popping out after dinner every evening so that Alistair can continue his work on my nude. We talk a lot, but he's still extremely secretive, never serious, and changing the subject every time it's about him. What inspired you to be an artist? I asked him the other day.
It's a long and dull story. I don't want to bore you, sweet Venetia.
That's what he calls me, sweet Venetia. I don't think anyone has ever called me sweet before. It's rather charming, don't you think? Even so, I do worry that he thinks I really am sweet, all young and naive. I keep telling him how I'm famed for my raciness, but he simply isn't surprised by me. Not in the way that the others are. He's heard all my witty lines and seems to have played this game 1,000 times. It's as if he sees the real Venetia inside. And you know what, Angie? I don't want to pretend anymore. I want to be the real Venetia. Not just what's fashionable or daring, but someone complicated and substantial. And he's the one who's opening it up for me. Last night, we talked about poetry, and he made up a poem about his love for me. As beautiful as a summer breeze. I won't bore you with the details, but honestly, Angie, there's nothing like hearing the man you love expressing his adoration for you with such eloquence and fervor. He always has more intellectual matters on his mind, talking about Greek philosophy or medieval politics. The wireless is continually on, sputtering out the latest war news. And once he surprised me by getting quite cross at something they said. The news was about the Nazi invasion of Belgium, which has caught our war chiefs by surprise. They used an indirect route while we were busy guarding the proper way, the one they'd used last time. What a military catastrophe, he muttered under his breath. I thought you were a pacifist, I said nonchalantly. He picked up his brush again, as if remembering I was there.
Of course I am. But what a dreadful pack of idiots we are to underestimate the Nazis, eh?
Why don't you sign up? See if you can do better.
Are you trying to get rid of me, darling?
He replied in a playful sing-song way.
Push me out of your life forever.
He paused and looked at me again, stretched out before him.
Oh, Venetia, he said with gentle amusement. Do you know how beautiful you are?
I must have looked at him in such a way, as then something came over him, and he put his brush down and came around the easel
and lay next to me on the great red rug, pulling my naked body towards his fully clothed one.
"I need you, Venetia,"
he whispered into my ear, so blunt and direct that I was taken aback.
"I need you, and you need me. We need to be together."
I shifted back and looked into his dark, cavernous eyes, finding an intensity that was disarming, but crushingly compelling. The whole thing was exhilarating, Angie, and in an odd kind of way, a little frightening. As I returned his gaze, something new inside me seemed to explode open, like the cherry blossoms bursting open, and everything else seemed to dissolve into nothing. All the messing and the conniving and the boys, all the little games and affairs. I suddenly knew that this is what it's for. I finally met my match. Now all I need to do is get to the bottom of him. Meanwhile, more village news. Hattie named her baby Rose after her poor mother. She invited the Chilbury Ladies' Choir around her house to wet the baby's head with a few glasses of sherry and one or two songs. We're frightfully worried about the competition on Saturday, so quiet hopefulness, rather than the usual squabbling, seemed to be the dominant feeling. Although Mrs. B remains adamant that it's all an embarrassing mistake. Kitty is being incredibly nice for a change, although that's probably because she's still gloating about her soloist victory. Hattie brought the gorgeous baby out of her crib and sat down beside me on the sofa. "She's beautiful," I said. And for once, I meant it. Rose is the most gorgeous baby you'd ever see. Even you would think her a gem, with her big blue eyes and gurgling smile. "It's odd seeing you all grown up with a baby now," I said to Hattie. "It seems like yesterday the three of us were making that pact in the pixie ring, that we would stay together come what may. How funny it seems now."
"It does seem a long time ago, doesn't it?"
She smiled. And suddenly, I felt so very close to her again.
"Venetia, I'd like you to be Rose's godmother. Victor and I talked about it in our letters over these last few months, and both knew that you were the right choice," she said. "I know that Rose will grow to love you as I do."
"As I do you," I said hastily, feeling immensely touched and overwhelmed. "Thank you, Hattie. I'd love to be her godmother. What a wonderful idea. I'll make sure no harm ever comes to her." I looked down at the beautiful child, and I must admit, Angie, that with such an old friend as Hattie producing an angel like Rose, it made me wonder about having a baby myself. I'm sure the magnificent Mr. Slater would make the very best of fathers, don't you think? Hattie's being tremendously brave, but I know she's terribly worried about Victor. He's out in the Atlantic until next year, they say, and she hardly gets word from one month to the next. With news of ships torpedoed every week, I know she's wondering if he'll get back at all, if little Rose will grow up without a father. Oh, wouldn't it have been nice to be born 50 years from now, when all this is over, and we'll be back to normal? Imagine what the world would look like then. Will we be married and happy? Our children grown up with children of their own? Or shall we be famous for something or other, some daring deed or great invention? Obviously, that's assuming we'll still be here, and our dear country makes it through in one piece. I know you think I'm silly to fall in love, but Angie, maybe I'm just not the same as you, busily seducing every man in London. Maybe I need to do my own thing. I'll write again soon. Venetia.
Mrs. Tilling's Journal. Thursday, the 16th of May, 1940. The Litchfield Park bigwig, who is billeted to stay in my house, arrived this afternoon, amidst much confusion. He was supposed to come next week, so when I heard the doorbell, I thought it was the postman, and became flustered. The poor postman is the harbinger of sorrow these days. But when I opened the door, an extremely tall, middle-aged man stood on the doorstep in the pouring rain. His tan raincoat was soaked and clingy around his bulk, and his brown hair clumped wetly when he took off his sodden hat.
exposing a big, squashy face with a nose that looked like it had been broken at least once. "Oh," I uttered, looking at him accusingly, "you're not the postman." "No. May I come in?" he said, bad-temperedly, barging past me into the hallway, trying to brush off some of the rain. He put his somewhat shabby suitcase down next to the stairs. "May I ask who you are?" I said, rather crossly. "Colonel Mallard," he muttered. "As in the duck?" I asked vaguely. He didn't look like a colonel. He was wearing civvies and was frankly more than a little unkempt. He nodded, his eyes flickering over the dilapidated hall. The servants' dwindling has taken its toll on my poor house, although I was relieved when Mrs. Peck left, as I couldn't work out who was in charge of whom any more. "I'm afraid I'm in a bit of a hurry," the colonel said, turning towards the stairs. I glared at him, wondering what on earth he was doing. "Well, I don't know what you're in a hurry about, or what it has to do with me, but I would be grateful if you could tell me what you're doing here." "I've been billeted here." After scrambling around through his pockets, he dragged out a crumpled, soggy letter and handed it to me. "Oh," I had a quick look. "I was told to expect you next week. Your room's not even ready yet." "Well, I'll just have to make do with it the way it is, won't I?" he said, looking at the stairs impatiently. I led the way up, the man's heavy footsteps following me. Hardly bearing the notion of him inside David's room, I eased the door open, taking one last glimpse, one last breath of its peaceful air, before it became someone else's. The colonel was well over 6 foot, and the room suddenly seemed terribly small as he entered. I hurried back to the door, feeling a little claustrophobic. "I'll be downstairs if you need anything," I said, and disappeared off before I became teary. What a dreadful man. Although I suppose it could be a lot worse. He could smell of cow dung, or whistle, or even more dire, take up residence in my sitting room. It'll be awkward sharing my house with a stranger, so unlike the soft warmth of David. I wonder what Colonel Mallard does at Litchfield, as I worry that the war may be lost if this is the general countenance of the people we have in charge. He hardly looks like one of Mrs. B's important bigwigs. He's far too disheveled and disorganized, like a big old cardboard box. As I began peeling the potatoes for dinner, thinking of going over to see Hattie as soon as I could get away, I heard the door upstairs open, and for a split second I thought it was David, and his cheery voice would carry down the hall. "I'll be off now, Mum." The heavy tramp down the stairs jolted me back. "Mrs. Tilling," he called from the hallway. "Colonel Mallard," I replied, hurrying out of the kitchen, wiping my hands on my apron. "Will you be requiring dinner in the evening? If so, I'll need your ration book." "No, I'll eat at the canteen," he said, and then added, "Thank you," in an officious way. He held out a tattered satchel. I recognized it immediately as David's, realizing that I must have left it in the room when I began tidying everything away. I snatched it from him in annoyance. Why can't he leave everything alone? "Is that all?" I said, desperate for him to leave. But he stood for a moment looking through me, as if trying to remember if he had everything, and then turned and headed for the door, muttering a sullen goodbye. I closed the front door and wandered numbly back to the kitchen. From the window over the sink, I can see the tumble-down tower of the church, and if you climb to the top of that tower on a clear day, you can see the yellow-brown turrets and pinnacles of Litchfield University. I stood and thought about how my dreams have become smaller over the years, from when I was young and yearned to study, to meeting Harold and dreaming of my own family, to Harold dying and my world circulating around David, the only light left in my sad little life. And now,
All I dream is that he doesn't die. Everything else, including the new intruder, means nothing. To calm my nerves, I went for a brisk walk and found myself in the church, sitting in the pew at the back on the left, piecing together the new world around me. All right there? A voice came from behind, instantly recognizable as Prim. Yes. Just coming to terms with a strange colonel staying in my house. He's billeted with me. Before I found my house in Church Row, I stayed with a lovely old gentleman. He still joins me for tea from time to time. Perhaps it'll improve as you get to know each other. He's such a grumpy curmudgeon, I can't imagine ever getting on with him. I'll have to see if I can find another room for him somewhere else. I'm sure that if you take the time to talk to him, you'll realize he's just like you, or your son, or anyone else. There's a war on. Why not give him a chance? She had that twinkling little smile on her face, and I couldn't help but smile too. That's the ticket, she said, and continued her hurrying in and out with various music stands and scores. Prim, I began as she scuttled by. You coming here and reinstalling our choir has been such a tremendous lift for us. Do you really believe that singing will help us get through this gruesome war? Music takes us out of ourselves, away from our worries and tragedies, helps us look into a different world, a bigger picture. All those cadences and beautiful chord changes, every one of them makes you feel a different splendor of life. I wish I had your enthusiasm for something, I murmured. But you do, Mrs. Tilling. You do. Not for music, but for other things. You only need to stand back and see. I don't know how to do that, I said glumly. Well, let's start by cheering you up with a little singing. She took my arm and led me to the front. Standing me in the middle of the altar, she went back and plumped herself down on one of the front row seats. Now sing, Mrs. Tilling. Open your heart and sing. Just pick your favorite hymn. Well, that's I Vow to Thee My Country, I said. The thought of this powerful hymn making me warm to the idea. But I can't just sing here on my own. There's no one here except me. It doesn't matter if you do it wrong. I imagined the organ introduction and softly began humming it, until I opened my mouth and began to sing the first poignant words, sending them echoing clearly through the apse. I vow to thee, my country, all earthly things above, entire and whole and perfect, the service of my love. The hymn was sung at my father's funeral, as it was for so many of those men who died in the Great War. And then we sang it again at my mother's funeral, and then at Harold's. As I was singing it out alone in the church, it took on a new horror. I realized that I had been trapped by those deaths, that I had let them take over. And I now see that it is time to let them go.
Kitty Winthrop's Diary. Saturday, 18th of May, 1940. The choir competition. What an extraordinary evening. I am completely exhausted, dear diary, but I simply have to stay awake and write down everything, right from the very beginning. We were on tenterhooks as our small huddle gathered on the green watching for the bus, which was late. Hardly noticing the first few bulging raindrops plunging around us, we worried whether we'd even make it on time, let alone sing well.
"We'll be humiliated in front of the whole of Kent," Mrs. B kept saying, unable to get over the brass bones fact that we're a women's only choir now.
"But we'd be a women's only choir whether we wanted to be or not," Mrs. Quayle snapped. "There's no men left, or would you rather have no choir at all?"
"We are a group of upstanding ladies, Mrs. Quayle, not an unruly singing spectacle," snapped Mrs. B,
barging past her to be first in line as the bus swung dangerously around the square.
"Lady Worthing will have plenty to say about it, not to mention the Archbishop."
"Then why are you bothering to come?" Mrs. Quayle climbed on the bus after her. Mrs. B swung around.
"Someone has to witness the catastrophe."
Mrs. Tilling looked like she was about to have her fingernails pulled out. "We simply haven't practiced enough. I don't know what the Litchfield Times will say about a ladies' choir, but surely it would help if we were exceptionally good."
"Better to give it a try, though," I said, trying to rally everyone, but all I got were fraught faces and scoffs.
Sylvie sat glued to my side, whispering to me,
"It will be fine,"
in a very unconvincing way. She loves the choir as much as I do and has been helping with my solo by being an appreciative and only sporadically critical audience. Only Venetia looked unaffected. She's been in a world of her own since Mr. Slater came on the scene. She's only doing the competition because the choirs have their photographs in the papers. We finally arrived. Litchfield Cathedral is like a magical fairyland castle, with its dwindling spires and ornate buttresses, and is surrounded by roses of the palest of pinks and yellows. Incredibly grand, yet impossibly romantic. The architect must have been in love. It's where Henry and I are to be married, I have decided. Today, however, the roses hung loosely as the rain battered down on us, and we joined the throng of people rushing in for the competition. Mrs. B battled her way through the crowded vestibule to see the list that had been pinned to a notice board.
"We're going last,"
she announced when she huffed back to the group.
"That's good," Mrs. Quayle said cheerily. "We can watch the competition and see who we have to beat."
"Nothing of the sort," Mrs. B snapped. "Our voices will be quite ruined by that time of night. It's becoming more of a disaster with every turn."
Prim's theatrical voice rang out.
"We'll end the evening on a high note."
We took our seats in the old stone interior. The lovely stained glass windows had been covered with blackout material, making us feel enveloped in a massive underground burrow. As the place became full, the gnome-like Bishop of Litchfield walked to the front and asked for quiet in strong nasal tones, making me think his wire spectacles were too tight. He quickly presented the puffed-up mare, complete in full red robes, who pompously began a lengthy speech about the joys of song in the horrors of war, and the terms uplifting the spirit, heralding a new tomorrow, and striving onward were all trotted out. Ever since Mr. Churchill has started broadcasting wonderful speeches, everyone else is trying it out. There were four choirs in the competition, the other three being normal men and women choirs. We were to sing in order, followed by brief refreshments, and then the judging panel would announce the results. I trembled in my shoes and looked over to Prim. She was looking very pleased with herself, her hands clasped across her rounded midriff, eyes twinkling and the little V of a smile on her lips. Even though I think she's the best choir mistress in the whole country, I couldn't help a nagging suspicion that maybe we weren't ready for this. Maybe the countryside wasn't ready for a women's-only choir. But then she caught me looking at her and gave me a flicker of a wink. And I knew then that everything would be all right. With her at the helm, we'd be fine. Heavy rain began, spattering the roof and engulfing us as if we were all sheltering under the same umbrella. A clap of thunder echoed around the vaulted ceilings, and we huddled together, more in fear than anything else, while the other choirs trooped up to the front to perform. All about our competitors. One, the small Rise Home Choir, sang a very nice Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring. Two, the huge Litchfield Choir, incredibly good, and we agreed that they were going to win, followed by more suggestions that we should back out. Three, the Belton Choir, not so good, which perked us up, thinking we might not be last. Next was us. My heart was clattering like castanets as the bishop announced us. A series of murmurs echoed around the church, people questioning whether they'd heard right, no doubt. "Did he say the Chilbreed Ladies' Choir?" I heard someone behind us say with astonishment. We looked at Prim with anguish, but she was standing ready to file out to the aisle, beckoning us to follow suit. We sat, terrified, glued to our seats like a huddle of wild rabbits in hunting season. But then suddenly, a deafening crack of thunder came. The congregation stopped in unison and looked to the ceiling as the lights blinkered, then blinkered again, and died. We were plunged into darkness, the kind of blackness that makes you feel that you haven't got your eyes open when you know you have. Everyone began frantically whispering.
"At least we can go home now," Mrs. B sniffed. "Escape this dreadful ordeal."
Then came the nasal voice of the bishop.
"Don't worry, everyone. Just stay where you are and we'll get some candles."
The whispers grew until, from behind us, a glimmer of light came from the vestry as a single candle was carried to the altar. It was a girl, maybe about 10 years old, holding her hand around it to stop it from flickering as she moved slowly forward. Another girl came up behind her, a few years older, and then a woman, and then more people, each holding a lit candle, coming up the aisle and dividing at the altar to place their candle in a new dark corner. After a few minutes, candles of different lengths and shapes had been placed around the massive ancient interior, some in candlesticks of silver and gold, others long pillars of angelic white. Soon the scent of the hundreds of glowing wicks wafted around, the shifting shadows bringing the ancient statues to flickering life.
"Will we still be able to sing?" I whispered. "What about the organ? It's not going to work now we don't have electricity."
"We'll do without it," Prim said jauntily, as if it were a bit of a lark and not a colossal disaster.
"How will we know the right note to start?"
I was panicking. We were barely ready to sing, let alone this.
"I shall hum the first note for the altos as they come in first, and I'm afraid the sopranos are going to have to use that note to find their own. Kitty, we will have to rely on your keen skills."
She grinned at me, and I was at once elated and terrified. We got up quietly, the hammering of the rain drowning our chairs and feet as we worked our way to the front and took our places on the altar step. There was a slight rustle of papers as we found our music, hands shaking with nerves. Prim was holding her baton aloft, her eyes large and bright as she caught each of ours ready to begin. In the silence, we heard her hum a single note, flowing through the candlelight like a small silver dart. I saw her catch Mrs. Tilling's eye and nod.
If Mrs. Tilling had the note, we knew the altos would be all right.
Prim lifted her baton, eyes closed as if in prayer, and as she brought her arms down, Mrs. Tilling's clear, held note rang out through the church, surrounding the mass with glowing warmth. The other altos joined in for a wonderful full sound. I was petrified. The sopranos would be counting on me to guide us in. I thought I had the note. Knew I had the note, but did I have the confidence to sing it out? What if I just opened my mouth and nothing happened? But the moment had arrived. Prim's eyes narrowed on me. She raised her arms and then brought them down, both baton and forefinger pointing at me, and I heard our first note carrying through the flickering candlelight like pure cut crystal.
"Someone else must have got it," I thought,
until I realized that it was my own voice I was hearing. I looked over at Prim, praying I'd got it right. But she had her eyes closed, a smile of serene contentment on her face. The sound swelled as the other voices joined mine. I had done it! Me, Kitty Winthrop, I'd saved the choir! A surge of exhilaration gushed through me, knowing that Prim had recognized my talent, had faith in me. I had carried the choir through and made them proud of me. The solitary beauty of our unaccompanied voices soared up in the desolate, dim church, weaving in and out, climbing higher and more passionately until the breathtaking climax. It was magnificent. Angelic. Even I could tell. My solo was up first, and I felt my throat dry to nothing as the chorus came to an end, marking the place where I came in. Prim's eyes were on me, her baton poised, and then I opened my mouth for the first note to ring out. Ave Maria. I slowed slightly. My nerves were getting to me. But the top notes were firm, clear, crisp, lingering as all eyes were on me. And then I continued as the notes swept down, and I suddenly felt an elation, as if the piece of music belonged to me, and I sang as if it were part of me, from some new reserve deep inside. I came to the end, allowing the final note to slowly ebb away, catching Prim's eyes, her nod, and I knew that it was the best performance I could have given. The best I have ever sung. The chorus resounded beautifully around me, and we began looking at Mrs. Tilling, as it was her solo next. She had been incredibly nervous beforehand, repeating that she didn't want to let us down. "But you won't," said Prim. "You have to trust your voice." The chorus drew to an end, and I watched Prim look at her, lift her baton, and bring it down. Mrs. Tilling's voice was superb, the mellowness deep and rich like a late summer's night. She paused slightly before the high note, making it even more poignant, even more beautiful, and after that the notes seemed to flow like gold from her, straight from her heart. The rest of the choir joined in for the final chorus, the wonderful fullness of sound surrounding us again. Came the calming lull of the slowly undulating final notes, dissipating into the eerie darkness. There was a pause through the cathedral, only the drumming of the rain echoing through the apse. Then the applause started, growing to a hearty surge, and I found a tear coming down my face. We had made it. I had made it! Prim beamed a look of gratitude at me as we went back to our seats, and inside I rejoiced. I didn't care if we won or lost. I had saved the day, as had Mrs. Tilling. The nasal bishop came to the front again.
"I'm afraid that refreshments have to be cancelled because of our diminishing candle supplies. So please could everyone keep their seats for a few minutes, and hopefully we can give you the results shortly."
Everyone began whispering, except for Mrs. B, who loudly proclaimed that Mrs. Gibbs had sung off-key for the entire performance and that, should we lose, we'd know where the blame should be placed.
"Either that or we'll be eliminated for not having men," she sniffed.
"We have nothing to worry about," Prim smiled. And I suddenly began to doubt if she really knew the countryside, how attached everyone is to tradition around here. There's something called conventional wisdom, which means we have to carry on doing things the same way, even when it doesn't make sense. That's what the countryside's about. Litchfield especially. A minute later, the nasal bishop returned to the front, this time with the mayor beside him to announce the winner. The mayor began to give another speech, and then, thankfully, the bishop leaned over and had a word in his ear, which was probably, "Get on with it!" And he started to announce the runner-up.
"Litchfield!"
he announced as the choir master tottered up and received the certificate. That would mean we thought that the winners would be Risehome, as surely no one would vote for Belton.
"And the winner, who will represent the Litchfield area in St. Paul's Cathedral in the finals,"
he rustled some papers annoyingly,
"is the Chilbury Ladies Choir."
We leapt out of our seats. Mrs. Quayle gasped. "What did he say?" Mrs. Tilling spluttered. "We weren't eliminated." Mrs. Gibbs said, "Was that really us?" Then Mrs. B pushed her way through to the aisle.
"Pull yourselves together! Of course we won! What were you expecting?"
We followed her up the aisle, where she was busy pumping the bishop's hand as if she was solely responsible for the entire thing. I looked around for Prim, and serene as ever, she was floating up the aisle after us, her long cloak flowing behind her like a great protective owl. After we took a bow, we got together for photographs. Of course, Venetia made sure she was centre stage, hair perfect, which was funny as she was standing beside Mrs. Gibbs, who looked like an unhinged hen, with coats and scarves at all angles and hair like a bird's nest. There were some photographers there from the Kent Times, and even a national paper. They're grabbing any happy stories they can these days. We filed over to shake hands with the judges who were sitting at a fold-up table at the front. First was the mayor, and beside him Mrs. Mandelson, who is the rather severe Lichfield WVS leader. Then there was pompous Lady Worthing, who stood proffering her white-gloved hand as if we were diseased. Mrs. B was doing her hideous false laugh at something she said, and we grimaced with embarrassment. The final judge was the head of Lichfield Park, a giant of a man who looked untidy even though he was in uniform. Mrs. Tilling whispered to Mrs. Quayle that he's the man billeted at her house. "Didn't realise he was the head of Lichfield Park," she muttered, irritated. "What a strange choice." I wondered why she was being such a sourpuss, but then I saw that he too frosted over as she pushed her hand to shake his. "Well done, Mrs. Tilling," he said non-committally. She flustered, embarrassed. "I didn't realise you were one of the judges. I really don't know what..." "Thank you for voting for us," I said quickly, as it was a bit mean to question his judging ability when we just won. He smiled warmly at me. "It was an easy choice, especially with your solo performances." Maybe he wasn't so bad after all. Mrs. Tilling tried to ignore him, making a small humph sound before turning to me and saying in a very forced way, "Come on, Kitty, and you, Sylvie, we need to find Prim," and making a bolt for the vestry. The rest of the evening was a blur of congratulations, with cheers and patting on backs, and the other choirs pretending they were pleased for us. A journalist asked us how we felt being a women's only choir. "We're starting a new trend," Venetia declared, preening before him. "We're all the rage, didn't you know?" The man stood gawping at her until Mrs. B barged in, saying, "We always believed we would win, men or no men." And we all nodded and smiled. After a while, the crowds began to dwindle, and the bishop had to shoo us out, so we made our jolly way back to the bus and set off jubilantly for Chilbury, singing all the way. But we didn't sing Ave Maria. No, we sang old music hall songs, including my new favourite, "Can't Get Away to Marry You Today. My Wife Won't Let Me."
Letter from Colonel Mallard to his sister, Mrs. Maud Green, in Oxford. Ivy House, Lichfield Road, Chilbury, Kent. Monday, 20th of May, 1940. Dear Maud, apologies for my lack of contact, but I've been caught up with the recent events in Belgium and northern France. This letter comes to you from my new billet in Chilbury. Have you been here on your travels? Please tell the girls to write to me here, as letters to the MOD always get diverted via London. Do encourage them to write. Frankly, their letters are the only things that keep me going in this dreadful war. Once again, many thanks for looking after the three of them. I do hope they're behaving themselves. I know that Vera would be happy knowing they are with you, God rest her soul. I can't believe it is 5 years on Wednesday that she died. I can still hardly get used to the fact that she has gone. I'll be here for the summer, I'd imagine, probably beyond. The woman who owns the house, a Mrs. Tilling, is a nurse, who seems to disapprove of everything and everyone, and especially me. She's a stick of a woman with a never-ending supply of dull grey housecoats, hardly speaks a word, except to give me polite orders, and has been particularly bad-tempered since I asked if I could have dinner at home, demanding my ration book and crashing pots around the kitchen in annoyance. "I'd like it, Colonel Mallard," she said crisply to me last night, "if you could let me know at what time you will be home for dinner." I'd only been an hour late the previous night. Similarly, one evening, I decided to move the small chest of drawers, as it makes much better space if it goes in the nook beside the wardrobe. The next day, it had been returned to its usual position, and I decided not to attempt any further furniture rearrangements. But then, on Saturday, I was forced into being a judge for a choir competition. And would you believe it? She sang a solo, and it was so wonderful and expressive. It was as if she was a different person. I can't make head or tail of her. Most evenings when I come in, she disappears completely. I hear a door slam upstairs, or see the curtain swing in the front room window as I approach. It would be nice to have some company, but I usually end up trudging upstairs to be by myself. Her son has just left for France, and she is openly resentful that I am staying in his room. There's not much to be resentful about, if you ask me. A small, lumpy bed and a picture of the solar system on the wall. We are a tiny, self-destructive dot in a mass of grey blackness. Enough for now. I'll write to the girls Wednesday, after I've been to the church to say a prayer for Vera. I hope she's watching down on us, keeping us safe. Much love, Anthony.
Kitty Winthrop's Diary. Saturday, 25th of May, 1940. The Eventful Picnic. Since it was such a heavenly morning, I decided that Sylvie and I deserved a treat after our choir competition victory. I felt an urge to pretend, at least for one day, that the war wasn't happening. So I flung open my bedroom window to feel the warm yellow sunlight on my face, smelling that fresh piney scent of a sumptuous spring morning. It was so utterly perfect that I decided to dedicate the day to a search for lost time and to recapture some of my childhood. On days like these before the war, we used to get dressed up and go on picnics with the Tillings or the Brampton Boyds, the girls in summer frocks, the boys in smart suits. Proggart would get cook, who has now left to make tanks in Tonbridge, to prepare a picnic luncheon packed with pies and cherries and madeleines. The smell of those delicious buttery cakes always takes me back to waiting eagerly in the kitchen before tasting the first warm bite of the fresh cakes as they came off the cooling racks. Today, we had to make do with Elsie putting some jam sandwiches together in a terrifically offhand manner, asking all kinds of questions about Henry. Questions Elsie wanted to know about Henry. What's his favourite food? Roast pheasant, of course, and spotted dick pudding. What's his favourite sport? Shooting, fox hunting, and cricket. Does he like Venetia? No, of course not. Does he have a girlfriend at his base in Hampshire? No, of course not. What's his favourite colour? Azure blue. What does he like to do for fun? Picnics? Parties? And he's rather good at croquet. I think she was trying to help me win him over, although she wasn't being terribly useful. Sylvie nudged me, whispering that I shouldn't tell her anything, although I have no idea why. Sometimes Sylvie seems to completely misunderstand what's going on. After we'd sorted out the sandwiches, Sylvie and I had the important task of choosing our dresses. I took Sylvie to my room and found one of my old ones for her, the white one with tiny turquoise flowers, the one that I wore the time Henry proposed to me. It brought back the flood of memories, boating on the lake, Venetia storming off up the banks, Henry stumbling after her and landing me in the bracken, getting my dress muddy, him promising to love me forever if I forgave him, and then roaming the countryside with him, calling Venetia's name, until we found her on top of a hill, sulking beneath a sprawling oak tree. She refused to speak to Henry, and would only come back to the picnic with me, gloomily trudging back as I skipped for joy, thrilled that my future had been mapped out to perfection. In the spirit of remembering,
I decided that I should wear Venetia's sky blue dress, as that was the one she was wearing that day, and I stole into her room to borrow it. Although it was a little large, it was perfect. Sylvie and I sneaked into Mama's dressing room to peer at ourselves in her big mahogany mirror. We looked impeccable. The sky blue dress was just the thing for a picnic, and Sylvie looked lovely too in the white frock. She's a pretty girl, with her unruly dark curls always plastered behind her ears, although she hardly says a word. We used to think she was quiet because her English wasn't very good, but now we know that her English isn't bad at all, except for when she misunderstands things, like the whole Henry situation. So when she doesn't talk, it's simply because she doesn't want to. I sometimes ask her about her secret, but she looks very alarmed and stops speaking immediately. I often wonder what her life was like back in Czechoslovakia. The food was different, that's for certain. She barely touched anything for weeks when she arrived, and has been living on bread rolls and jam for the main part. Mama tries to tempt her with bacon or roast beef, but she won't touch a thing. The difference between Czechoslovakia and Chilbury, from what I can gather. Czechoslovakia has more chocolate. Sylvie adores chocolate, and it's rare here now the war's on. Chilbury has hills with fields and woods, whereas Czechoslovakia has more forests. They both have horses. Sylvie loves horses. In Czechoslovakia, Christmas is always snowy and there are magical Christmas markets. There was no war in Czechoslovakia. The Nazis simply took over one day. All Sylvie's belongings are in Czechoslovakia, in her big house with a veranda. All Sylvie's family are in Czechoslovakia, waiting for her by the front door, her mother wearing a white spring dress like the day she waved goodbye at the station, her father in his suit and hat with a big smile warming her chilling bones, and her baby brother Myla, giggling in his blue blanket as she takes him from her mother's arms for one final kiss. With a last look at our reflections in the glass, we decided we were ready and dashed downstairs, scooping up the picnic basket as we raced through the kitchen and side door into the pale, clear morning. The tall grass in the meadow was still wet from the rain last night, the multitude of droplets glistening like a thousand fallen stars in the thick field of the brightest green. There was that smell you get after a big storm, a new freshness as if the rain has washed away all the dust and dirt and horrid things that people shout at each other, and are left reverberating in the air, waiting for the thunder to deafen it all out. I decided that we'd go down to the little wooden bridge beside the Dawkins's beehives, as there are lots of wild flowers, and you can place stepping stones across the stream. We went there on a picnic a few years ago when the motor car wasn't working. No one got stung that time. It was quite a walk, and when we got there, exhausted and ready for our picnic, we were rather peeved to find it already occupied. A boy was building a dam. "Hello there," he called, standing shakily on a tree branch that was covering half the width. Then, steadying himself, he trotted over to the bank to greet us. He was older than I thought, tall and lanky like big boys are before they become men, his tatty shorts and rather unkempt appearance making him look younger from afar. He had a curious face, kind of spoon-shaped, his chin and forehead jutting out further than the rest of it. Handsome. Not handsome like Henry, but still not bad-looking for a boy. Clearly enjoying himself, he grinned in the sunshine, putting a dirty hand up to shield his eyes from the sun as he hollered up the bank to us. "Come down and join in!" His voice was thick and cockney. Since Sylvie was already halfway down the slope, I felt obliged to add my protection, and we were soon beside him. "I'm Tom," he said, still smiling, his mouth open as he panted, hands on hips as he appraised his dam. "How do you do?" I said, unsure whether to shake hands. "My name is Kitty and this is Sylvie." Sylvie actually smiled. Did she like him? "What are you children doing round here?" Tom said. "We are not children," I corrected. "She is," he said, jabbing his head towards Sylvie and laughing. "Yes," I relented, infuriated by his rudeness. "I suppose she is, but I'm not."
How old are you, 12? 14, I smarted, my hand nudging against Sylvie to stop her from calling me a liar. I am almost 14, after all. Well, almost, almost. But more to the point, what are you doing here? I asked crossly. The land belongs to the farm, as do the bees. We're here for the hop picking. He jerked his head behind to the hop pickers' huts by the barn. Every year, Dawkins Farm gets about 50 Londoners to come and help out with farm work, then pick the hops when they're ready. They live in rows of huts. It all seems frightfully squalid to me, but apparently it's exactly how they live in London. Better, even. How long have you been here? I demanded, my eyes narrowing with distrust. I was still miffed he'd called me a child. I only came last week with my auntie. My mum had to go help out in a factory, and no one knew what to do with me. I told them I wanted to fight. He thrust a few tidy punches into the air. But they said I'm too young. How old are you? Nearly 14. Strong as any man. Probably stronger. He showed us his biceps, which were puny, but we didn't say anything. I felt sorry for him. His face was so open and funny that you couldn't possibly think he was up to no good. Come and help me with the dam, he ordered. Get that branch there and bring it along. Fortunately, the dam was stable enough for us to totter to the halfway point. Unfortunately, we'd quite forgotten about the bees, which suddenly surrounded us, buzzing furiously at Sylvie. Tom to the rescue! Tom cried, flailing his arms around like a deranged orangutan. No, not like that, I cried. Well, this city idiot clearly hadn't got a clue about bees. Keep still, and they'll go away. I trotted as fast as I could back to the bank, almost falling in once, picked up a long, narrow branch and held it out to Sylvie for her to make her way back without panicking too much. Although I must say she was the calmest of us all, an amused little smile on her lips like the Mona Lisa having some kind of private joke. Once on land, I opened our basket, found a jam sandwich, and as the bees headed straight for it, I flung it as far as I could up the bank, in the direction of the beehives. It did the trick all right, luring the bees away, although one of them stung me on the elbow as he went past the monster. I screamed, and Tom came bounding over, grabbing my arm in a most ungentlemanly way. We all looked down at the growing mound of pink. "You'll need some vinegar on that," he said. "Don't be ridiculous," I said sharply. "Didn't this boy know anything? We need honey." "If you want honey, I know where to get some." "Do you?" I asked warily. Honey wasn't easy to get these days. He brushed down his rather tatty shorts and then pointed out his arm. "Step this way, young ladies." We collected our things and followed him up the bank, giving the basket to him to carry since my arm hurt and Sylvie is too small. He led us back along the side of the orchard to Peas Potter Wood, and at the cusp of the wood he turned, glanced around furtively, then headed in. We hurried in after him. After a short walk, he pushed his way into a massive bush, the type that is hollow on the inside and packed with tiny close leaves around the edge. After a minute or so of rummaging in the shrubbery, he reversed back out. In his hand was a jar of honey. It must have been home-produced, as it had a blue gingham cover and a white label saying Alicott Farm. I couldn't help wondering where I'd heard that name before. He took off the top and stuck a grubby finger in, stuffing the yellow fingerful in his mouth. I wanted to stop him. He was tainting all that honey. It was disgusting. "Is honey all right?" He chomped his mouth about, savouring the flavour. "Try some." Sylvie stuck her finger in and tentatively put it in her mouth, and the look of pleasure on her face finally made me give in and try it too. It was the most divine honey I've ever tasted, all rose petals and syrupy sweetness. We all took another fingerful, and I smeared a little on my sting. "What's it doing in the bush?" "I've seen old George put it there," Tom said. "He's an old crook who stays in one of the hop huts. We don't bother him much." He bit his lip awkwardly. "He's got a knife and things. Threatened our Charlie, so we leave him well alone." "Should we be taking his things?"
"'Spies not,' Tom said with a small lilt of a skinny shoulder. "'It's black market, of course. "'I only take a few bits at a time, nothing he would notice.' "'A noise in the bracken startled us. "'We looked around, but there was nothing there.'